another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, minister, and friend, Chino Ross, pastor and the voice of the Understanding Scripture and Truth by Chino D. Ross YouTube channel. Chino, it's good to be back and to talk about all things women in ministry. I'll never forget, there was a point in time, you and I have talked about this a little bit, but there was a point in time, I have walked away from this quite a few times now, and one of the times that I walked away, I handed everything over to a fellow researcher who was very, very knowledgeable about all of the research I was doing into Jim Jones. Had contacted the Jonestown Foundation, and that's actually how I met this person. They had escaped the cult, and they were helping me help a lot of people out, and so it just made sense. I handed over to her, and when I handed it over to her, and she started putting out podcasts and blog posts, etc., you can imagine the outcry because, oh no, John has hired a woman preacher. that was the comment. And she wasn't preaching at all. She was just sharing research, and she was going through the Bible and finding, well, this doesn't match what we were taught, and just simply telling what she found and read. And there's this such a programmed response to having a woman correct you, which is so funny in the movement, man, because there are times whenever the woman's actually right and you're actually wrong as a male. I have come across it many times with my wife, and the times that I think I'm right and she's wrong, well, she's still right. but I think that's something's a little taboo in this type of ministry, and I have some facts to share with you. I know you do, and there's a lot we're going to get into today.
Even when you're positive, 100% certain that you are right and your wife is wrong, you're still wrong. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's an explosive topic. And the only reason really that I'm approaching this is because it's of its connection to Hobart Freeman. So there was a cornerstone in Dr. Freeman's ministry was the often recounted story of how the prophetess Anna Schrader had prophesied over him in Dallas, Texas in 1966, and in that prophecy had appointed him to this end time ministry. So that is hugely significant in Dr. Freeman's life and ministry. So I will say at the beginning, John, whether you are in favor of women in ministry, and by in ministry, I mean teaching, pastoring, elders, all of that, or whether you're not, that makes no difference at all to what we're going to be covering today. This is simply my attempt to show what Dr. Freeman's view was about women in ministry, how it changed and how it changed again, and then, in my opinion, how there was a cover-up involved, very disingenuous, by him trying to put the blame for the people not understanding why he is saying what he's saying, putting the blame on them rather than simply acknowledging, hey, listen, guys and gals, I've changed my opinion on this topic. That is something Hobart Freeman simply was averse to doing. He did change his opinion on many topics, as all of us have, but the proper way to go about it, especially when you're a leader in a big church and a big movement, is to explain the transition in your own theology and in your own mind, where you were, why you're there no longer, and give all the reasons why, and give people time to adjust to that. And that is something that Dr. Freeman was not very good at all. So as I said, in the very beginning, when Hobart was newly charismatic, and maybe starting in the next podcast, John, we're going to actually give the historical details and data of this Anna Schrader business, because it's hugely important. People are very curious about it. Anybody who's been under the sound of Hobart Freeman's ministry has heard the name Anna Schrader and knows that he went to Dallas, Texas in 1966, and that's where I received this end time message of faith, this end time ministry of faith by God's prophetess prophesying over me, Anna Schrader. We do actually have a lot of details of that summer meeting. It was actually in June of 1966 in Dallas, Texas, and we'll talk about that more next time. But for today, you know, what was the foundation? Here is a ex-seminary professor, old dry scholar in Hebrew and Old Testament. And what is he doing with a faith message and a faith ministry? How did that all come about? Well, again, it all traces back to, first of all, his experience in the spring of 1966 at McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago, where he and June were guests of Dr. John Ray and his wife. Dr. Ray was a former colleague of Hobart's at the seminary, guest of theirs at a full gospel meeting where Hobart received the baptism in the Holy Spirit. So that is in March of 66. And here, just a couple of months later, he's down in Dallas, Texas. Anna Schrader gives this prophecy over him. And he ends up with what he called this end time message of faith. And he was very proud of that. And early on in his ministry, he saw himself not totally unique as he did at the end of his ministry, because we have references early on where he said that there were only maybe two other people in addition to himself, you know, who had this end time message of faith. So there is a little small clip, John, we're going to listen to on a very old tape entitled How to Release Faith. And there are actually several of these, at least two of these, that Dr. Freeman did. So let me just explain. Dr. Freeman would teach early on when he was traveling around to churches, to full gospel meetings. He would have messages, such as his famous message on Gideon's army. And he would just repeat that wherever he went, you know, to a new group who hadn't heard it. So he had several messages on faith. And depending on the audience, maybe they had not heard this from him before, so he would preach it to them. So he preaches this message entitled How to Release Faith in 1971. This is early. He's only been charismatic for 5 years. It's not at his home church. It is at some meeting down in Florida. I think it was early enough in Hobart's ministry to assume that he did not yet have the recognition that he would get in the by the mid-70s, where he could simply rent a hotel, announce a meeting, and attract a crowd. So early on, he'd be a guest speaker at just different churches, as well as a whole lot of the full gospel businessmen's meetings. I don't know which it was of these, but I know it was in Florida. When you listen to the message, you put all of this together. He was teaching in a location not very far from where he was saved. He was saved on the road home in Tampa to back to St. Pete in 1952, as he always tells. When you listen to his voice, it is so different from the Dr. Freeman you're accustomed to when he's teaching at his church and later on. And he was just absolutely as wild as a March hare being chased by a pack of beagles. He is name it and claim it, faith and healing, miracle story after miracle story. I mean, it's just rapid fire. And I remember in hearing this message, one of the statements I remember him saying, because it's just rapid fire of all of the proof texts for faith and healing. He has them all memorized, and they kind of get jumbled up in his mind sometimes, but they're all there, and it's just quotation after quotation. You know, you're snared with the words of your mouth. You can have what you say. The reason you don't have anything is because you're not confessing positively. And I mean, it is rapid fire. And then he goes on to say, and the gold and the silver on 1,000 hills are yours, because you're a joint heir, and Christ has them, and if Christ has them and you're a joint heir, then you have them. And And that's a verse he pulled out of Haggai where it says the gold and silver are mine. There's a verse in Psalm 50 that says the cattle on a thousand hills are mine. So he pulled the gold and silver out of Haggai, attached it to the thousand hills in Psalm, and just typical Freeman teaching back then. But we have about a minute that we're going to listen to here where people can get the feel for Hobart in 1971. It's from the 6:51 mark to the 7:54 mark.
As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. So if I think I'm sick, I'm sick. And if I don't think I'm sick, I'm not sick. I didn't say I couldn't fight a few symptoms. I'll tell you, you just have to give me more than one shot at you, because you'll hear things tonight that you've never heard before, because I only know about two others maybe that have the message of faith in this hour. And I don't mean there aren't people with faith, and the people who do, I'm not saying who do not preach faith, I'm saying who have a ministry of faith. And it's entirely different from anything you've heard or anything that your mind could imagine, because I didn't know there was such a ministry. I thought faith was a doctrine to be studied once every 3 years in the seminary. So every 3 years we studied the doctrine of faith. But praise the Lord, since the illuminating power of God came through the Holy Spirit, He's shown me that I can release faith for everything in the Word from Genesis to Revelation and have everything that I'm a joint heir to, and that happens to be the universe. The gold and silver on a thousand hills are mine. Well, I thought they belonged to Jesus. Well, I'm a joint heir with
him. And in addition to just getting to hear Hobart when he's, 51 years old, he's born in 1920, so he'd be 51 years old. In addition to that, what you heard him say is that there are only two other men who have been given the message of faith. We know one of them. That's Kenneth Hagin, because that's who Hobart learned it from. I'm not exactly for sure who the other one is, but it's so interesting, John, that within 5 years, he's saying that he has the message and he can think of two others. Rather than putting himself at the bottom of that pecking order, someone else, two other guys, had this message before I was ever on the charismatic scene, and I got the message from them. And what is that message? The end time message of faith. You know, I heard that 1,000 times when I first began listening to Hobart. And I didn't realize the significance of that statement in his mind until I had spent weeks of listening to tapes, and then it kind of became part of the coded language. Because when I heard end time, after I'd heard that enough from him, this end time, you know, then as a 17-year-old, I began asking myself, where have I been? I did not know that I was living in the last generation. I had no idea. I was a Christian. I was a member of a youth group in a Presbyterian church, but I didn't know I was this privileged to live in the last generation. And that's what Hobart meant by that. We are living in the end times. And he thought about it, talked about it, and, you know, he felt it so strongly that he would make statements saying that I don't think that we'll even get to the end of this decade. And this was the 1970s. We won't even get to the end of this decade. Guys like him and others, John, were always talking about the former rain and the latter rain. I mean, I heard Derek Prince teaching on the former rain and the latter rain. There were so many messages. Hobart talked about the former rain and latter rain all the time, although I don't believe he actually has a message on that, and maybe with good reason, because he was confused about when was the former rain and when was the latter. Because if you listen to some early tapes, you will hear, oh, the former rain. It's a famous passage from Joel 2 that I'll send to you, the former rain and the latter rain. The former rain, that was the day of Pentecost. That was back in the first century. And then the latter rain is what began at Azusa Street in 1901. But then if you listen to other messages, listen to this. He refined that. If you listen to other messages, that we're talking about the end times. We are living at the end of time. The former rain was Azusa Street, Topeka, Kansas, Charles Fox Parham, William Seymour, all of those people, 1901. That was the former reign, the early 20th century. And the latter reign is the neo-Pentecostal, neo-charismatic movement of the 1970s or 60s, really, for him. So it was just all completely confusing to me to try to figure out, am I in the former reign? Am I in the latter reign? I know I'm in the end times, and I know Jesus must be coming back any day now.
I have come to the conclusion that the whole thing was the acid rain, and it wasn't for our blessing. You know, so many things that you're talking about that really make me go back through some of my memories. And actually, I think I'm going to go a different direction than my memories. I'm going to go back to a podcast which you probably haven't heard, but was just released last Saturday. I had Franklin Hall's grandson on the podcast, and he was talking through many things that fully did not resonate with me theologically. and you can tell from the comment feeds, people wondering, John, why did you do this? What on earth were you thinking? But I have him on record saying many things that I suspected, but I didn't really have anybody to yet confirm it from some of the other leaders of Latter Rain. And that's where my podcast is interesting, because I can allow people who believe all kinds of things on the podcast. We're all researching, looking for truth. He came across my research, and he and I talked offline. He was a little surprised at what I had found, and was now revising what he thought based off of the facts that I had, and he wanted to share facts with me, so he did, and we did it on the podcast. But one of the things that he said, whenever you think about this doomsday theology that you're referring to, and the shift from latter rain means this one thing, now it means this other thing, it really comes down to its theater. It is religious theater, that's all it is. And they're teaching whatever comes out popular to the crowds. And that's one thing that he admitted Franklin Hall did. He mentioned many of the leaders, like Franklin Hall, had a stage persona that they would put on when they'd get on stage, and the act that they had didn't really match the person. And so as we're talking through that and his his unusual support for Gnosticism, I got to thinking back to the way the Gnostics were, and there was a group that Irenaeus mentioned that talked about lies for the sake of a holy end. So when Pentecostalism came out, and I'm not saying they're lying, you can take your own theology off of that if you want to, but there were some of them who preached that this that we have now is the latter rain to the former rain that fell at Pentecost, and that came out of 1906 Pentecostalism. I think that some truly did believe that, but then some of those same people started the second movement and shifted the timeline. F.F. Yeah. Bosworth was one of those guys. Bosworth started, he was basically resurrecting Dowie's ministry, and he and several others were Parhamites who were teaching the early form of the deliverance movement, which had killed some people in Zion, and they had to escape very narrowly escaping being prosecuted. I'll say it like that. But anyway, they started this deliverance thing, and many of them started saying that this is the second, this is the latter rain to the Pentecost. So this would, in fact, be the latter rain to the former latter rain's latter rain. And it really was all for theater. I don't know that many people really believe that who are teaching it, because how can you? If you have taught that this first version of Pentecostalism that we had is the latter rain to the Bibles, and the end of days is coming, which is what they taught, 1906 Pentecostalism. In fact, there were prophecies at Azusa Street of utter destruction of the cities, which never happened. So there were people who realized that those were failed prophecies. They did not come to pass, but it attracted a heck of a lot of people. Let's put on this theater and let's try it again and see what happens. And that's literally what they did.
And we're half a century or more removed from Hobart, saying that the 60s is really the true latter rain. Just every generation that comes along, I think, is going to say we're at the end of time. I would encourage people to go read that verse and read the context, by the way, John and Joel too. Both of those rains, Joel says, will come down in the first month. They both come down at the same time. And I think it has to do with Israel, and I don't think it has anything to do with Pentecostalism of the 20th century. But that's for another podcast or study. But this phrase of Hobart's, God has given me the end time, we discussed that message of faith. I didn't know there was a message of faith. I just thought there was the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, four Gospels, some epistles, Book of Revelation. I didn't know that there was a message, and it's really not a, we need the definite article, the message of faith. I learned that from Hobart Freeman, that there is the message of faith. It's the end time message of faith. It's trusting God for all your needs, no seatbelts, no lightning rods, no insurance, no medicine, no doctors, no leaning to the arm of the flesh. This is the end time message of faith. And so what we saw in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, by golly, it is still happening today, are all of these particular specialties where these ministers think, I have the message of faith. But Oral Roberts, he had the message of healing. And Ezra Coppin, he had the message of being slain in the spirit. And William Branham had the message of the word of knowledge. And T.L. Osborne had the gifts of healings. And Don Basham had a deliverance ministry. And this person had a fasting one. And that one had a holy laughter one. And, you know, people will travel great distances, I have found, to hear any novelty and to hear that, did you know that brother so-and-so is going to be in town and he has the message of fill in the blank. And so Hobart had the message of fill in the blank with faith. And it all goes back to Anna Schrader prophesying this to him. Anna Schrader was a confidant and a friend of Kenneth Hagin. And Hagin was a part of all of this stuff in the mid and late 1960s as well. And we know how important faith was to Kenneth Hagin. He is called, what, the father, the grandfather of the Word of Faith movement, the WOF, because he built this whole school, Rhema Bible Training Institute, and just trained these hundreds and, I guess, thousands of people on the basis of Mark 11:24. I knew Hagin before I knew Freeman, but I hadn't heard much of him. And when I heard Hobart stressing Mark 11:24, God's given me the message of faith. He's, and it's all based on this verse, Mark 11:24. It took me a few years before I could realize, oh, that's not original to you. You know, I thought it was when I first heard him, even though I'd heard Hagin, I just didn't pay enough attention, I guess. But Hobart, I was locked into. And once I began paying enough attention, then I realized, you didn't get this from God or from Mark's gospel, you know, originally. You heard Kenneth Hagin stressing so much the prayer of faith and the Mark 11:24 type faith. You believe, you receive when you pray, and then you shall have it. Every bit of that emphasis and even the way it was argued and presented wasn't original with Dr. Freeman. It came from Kenneth Hagin, and it could have even come from earlier sources as well. So we've got this man, John, who says he has the end time message of faith. And it took me several years, unfortunately, in my 20s. And it took just simply reading the Bible that I couldn't find any ministers that had a certain message. Like if you go over to Philippi, you can listen to Titus teach, and he'll be teaching on deliverance because God's given him a deliverance ministry. When you looked at all of them, Titus, Timothy, Barnabas, Paul, Apollos, Peter, James, John, all of them, what they went around the Mediterranean world teaching was the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ and what that meant and all of the aspects connected to that. That is from cover to cover in the New Testament. And of course, you hear the word and read the word faith or healing or demons or gifts, but you don't see anybody who has, oh, he has the gift of the word of knowledge, and this one over here has the gifts of healing. All of these particular specialties, in my opinion, you know, are not biblical at all. The biblical message is all centered around the cross of Christ, preaching Jesus, his death and his burial and his resurrection. And so to come across someone who is saying, I have been given an end time message of faith, you know, eventually is going to cause me to question some things. So let's go a little further then with this, because I do want to talk about women in ministry simply because Hobart claimed to have this ministry message from a woman, from a prophetess, Anna Schrader. So early in Dr. Freeman's charismatic ministry, this was not a historical fact that he tried to hide, John. He told over and over the story of the prophetess. Some of the messages will have it a little more in detail. Some of it he will just mention it in passing. And so we've got to put this within context. Dr. Freeman came from a Southern Baptist and then a Grace Brethren background where women were not allowed in a leadership role based on 1 Timothy 2. Women were not allowed in ministry and women were not allowed in a leadership role. So that's Hobart's background. Hobart gets introduced to the charismatic movement, the Pentecostal movement of the 1960s, and we know that those both were equal opportunity employers. There were men and women everywhere. As I mentioned earlier, one of the most famous women, the name is still regularly on people's lips, is Amy Semple McPherson. So we go way back to the early Los Angeles days, the early 1900s. You've got Amy Semple McPherson. You have other people like Maria Woodworth Etter, Jesse Penn Lewis. You have all kinds of women who were in ministry in Pentecostal and charismatic circles. And then when you come down to today or just modern times, well, Kenneth Copeland's wife, Gloria Copeland, you know, was an accomplished speaker, and she was out there traveling and behind the podium preaching, you know, almost as much as her husband, Kenneth, was. Kenneth Hagin trained men and women, allowed men and women in ministry. One of the important women under his ministry, and I don't know if you guys on your end, John, have done any research on Billy Brim. She actually lived in Minnesota, so I knew of her back in the days I lived in Minnesota, but I think she had been either a secretary of Kenneth Hagin or some kind of assistant of his, but herself became a prophetess. I think they call her, and she's still alive today. You can hear her on YouTube, a Dr. Billy Brim. So it's some honorary degree. I don't know if given at Hagin School or Oral Roberts School or where. But, you know, even to this day, many of the wives of Pentecostal or charismatic leaders, pastors, are listed as the co-pastor of the church. And so this is what Hobart Freeman was birthed into when it comes to his charismatic experience. Women were in ministry in every regard, and Hobart Freeman had no problem with that at all. And you know that from the context into which he was birthed after being baptized in the Holy Spirit.
One of the things that was really shocking to me as I was trying to untangle the mess that was in my head was going through the study of women in ministry. Now, this was before the lady come and helped me with the website, but we were taught, much like you described the Baptist being taught, women should not be behind the pulpits. And I'm not arguing in favor, pro or con. That's up to you listening in your doctrines. But the thing that I did find was, much like you're describing with Hobart Freeman, Branham was all over the place. and purposefully so. He was disguised as a Pentecostal minister, disguised as a Baptist minister, pretending to have came in by accident into Pentecostalism, but he was a Pentecostal to begin with. And Pentecostals, as you mentioned, many of them were favorable of having women ministers. So here he is pretending to be a Baptist. He's actually the leader of a Pentecostal sect. He has a female teaching his Sunday school at the Branham Tabernacle, which was my grandfather's church. Now, that's the historical version. The stage persona version, which I learned later, was that he left the Baptist church over the idea that they were allowing women to be ministers, which wasn't quite right. I started looking into that, and no, they actually did not do this. And what he was referring to was Roy E. Davis, his mentor's Pentecostal sect, which allowed women, female pastors. But the interesting part is, he talks about how saintly he was because he wasn't going to allow the female ministers. But as it turns out, his first wife was ordained as an elder. I don't know if you would call her a minister, but she was taking active parts in the church, teaching and teaching doctrine. You can find newspaper articles of her whenever he married her. And so he was he was deeply involved with the females. I'll just say it like that. And then obviously you find people like Amy Semple McPherson who are big in this. But fast forward to the latter rain years, the early years of what would become Pentecostalism, become Charismania. He is working with people like Anna Schrader, calling her prophetess. He's working with other females who are either actively in the ministry or evangelism or even translators who were preaching, which is kind of funny because the translator, if I remember correctly, the translator is preaching to an audience about how women should not preach to an audience. That's how weird this gets, man, if I remember correctly. But the thing of it is, it's all over the place because, again, it's more of a stage act than it is any sort of standardization of doctrine. They're appealing to the crowd and what the crowd wants to hear. And if the crowd wants to hear, we don't want female ministers, that's what they're going to preach. As with other things, if the crowd wanted to hear, we believe in Trinitarianism, Branham is praying to the Trinitarian God, the persons of the Trinity. But when he's preaching to the other crowds, he's condemning anybody who does to hell. So it really comes down to it's a crapshoot of what doctrine you get. The funny part of that is, and the part that does tie back to what you're saying, it was that crapshoot of doctrine, this blend of mess, that I believe helped him and Gordon Lindsay decide to start their deliverance training seminars, which eventually evolved into the deliverance training school that you're talking about. Because they had attracted such a crowd of a variety of people, they were all teaching them the doctrine of faith, which is what Hobart Freeman called. The doctrine of faith, in its essence, means the gospel of divine healing, which we've talked about. That was the doctrine of faith. So once Hobart comes in contact with this, he has come in contact with all of the different things that change his mind to what you're saying, but he learned it from these other sources.
And that's going to continue to be interesting the next couple of podcasts, John, as we develop that.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
If anyone has any doubts, all you need to do is find some of the earliest messages of Hobart's from the late 60s and from the early 70s. And he has a very, jovial, agreeable spirit to all women, speaking in a public setting, including women in all different types of ministry offices. And I want people to follow, by the time we're through with our discussion today, where Hobart ends up and what I think is just rampant and blatant dishonesty involved in where he ended up. And this is what upset me when I realized, now, wait a minute, this is not what you have been saying earlier. You almost get treated as though you're not very intelligent and you can't remember what you heard on a tape that was done 10 years earlier. So if you go to, say, I'm just going to mention a couple of things here, John. There's just so many of the early messages. He talks about, female missionaries in Mexico. There's a particular story he tells with that. Female missionaries in China, female missionaries in India. He talks about Jesse Penn Lewis, who is a woman, if people didn't know from the name, not a man. He was a huge follower of hers. You know, he bought into and drank deeply from all Pentecostalism, including all of the women teachers and prophetesses and ministers and missionaries and mystics and intercessors. He drank deeply from all of that and approved of all of that. So here is one, for instance, a very early message called The Fullness of God. All I'm going to do is just tell you what's on this. It is so early. It's in the Deeper Life series, and it's number 204, with 201 being the earliest one. And then he has lots and lots that will come under Deeper Life over the next 14 years. But this was done in the early 1970s, and what he says, I think somewhere around the 8-minute mark, it's early. People can go listen to it for themselves if they have any interest at all. But he's talking about this end time move and this special message, and we're privileged, and you need to get out and hear the word, and you can't get this anywhere. It's a Sunday night teaching, because he says, I didn't put my wife up to saying from the pulpit what she did this morning, Sunday morning in the pulpit, when she was got up and exhorted everyone and encouraged everyone. Now you need to get out to even the night services and listen to Hobart. You need to get out to all of them. Well, that's not something that would have been allowed later in Faith Assembly years for June Freeman to get up in front of the whole group and encourage them. You need to get out and hear my husband tonight, not just this Sunday morning. There was a message where a time where June, Hobart's wife, again, this is early on. This is back in the equal opportunity days, where what's good for one is good for all, where Bruce could not speak at his normal Friday night Glory Barn meeting. And so guess who filled the pulpit for him? June did. Hobart's wife filled the pulpit for Bruce in the mid 1970s Glory Barn for a Friday night meeting. And, you know, it wasn't a big deal then. You know, nobody caused a ruckus because, why not? Because they knew Freeman's in agreement with this. I mean, if Freeman had not been in agreement with that, June would never have done that. Freeman was in agreement. You could tell from all of the messages that Freeman was in agreement. So here's something we are going to listen to just briefly, John. And this is a clip from a tape done in 1970. Hobart did 5 messages in the book of Daniel, and then right after that he did 4 messages in the book of Ezekiel. This was before the Glory Barn days. This was before Jerry Irvin's garage days. This was early on. They're still meeting back in the church under the water tower in Claypool, Indiana. But Hobart has these other meetings in Indiana. One of them was in Muncie. One of them was in Anderson. And you can tell from the recording, one of these old messages, you hear a grandfather clock going tick, tick, cryptic. I mean, you hear it through the whole entire message because he's in someone's living room or someone's basement and they recorded the message. So he had a big meeting in Muncie and a big meeting in Anderson, mostly a whole lot of women, because probably the men were at work or weren't interested in religion, and all the women gathered together. And I mean, it was great times for the movement and for Hobart. I wonder where those dear and precious women are today, if any of them could even be alive. If you would have been in your, I don't know, John, 20s, early 30s, we're talking about 1970, you see what age these women would be today, but they're laughing and giggling and agreeing and just having a wonderful time. I mean, these are just wonderful messages to hear, because Hobart's wild, he's footloose and fancy free, got a whole group of women there, and he's teaching this, his, what he wants to say about some of the latter chapters of Ezekiel. So on this particular message from Ezekiel, which was entitled Rebuilding the Temple, Rebuilding the Temple, from the 40-minute, 31-second timestamp to the 42-minute and 55-second timestamp, you're going to hear him tell a little brief personal story about Catherine Kuhlman.
But I notice that those who have end-time message have, I don't say everyone, just to give you for an instance, not to have this, but I hear it all the time. I heard it all the way back from Pittsburgh, where I spoke over there last week. I stopped by Catherine Kuhlman's meeting. What was she preaching on? The soon appearance of Antichrist in the prophecy. Just like we preach it here, friends. I'll tell you, that big hall was packed out to hear what I give you in 15 minutes.
Great.
That's no criticism of her. What's the difference? You can't get him to cross the street in Adams to come to hear it. And packed out. I mean, that's big. What is it? Some auditorium.
Carnegie Hall.
Well, this is big.
It's not ball halls. Dan ball.
And they just sitting there drinking. 3 hours. I mean, our actual teaching was just a few minutes. All the other was singing. So,
I mean,
what gets them out? I'll tell you what gets them out. It's the science of the anointing. That's why you need to pray for it. You need it. I've contended that all along. There's no place. There's a place for the word. If she didn't bring the word forth, then there'd be no place for the other. Because you don't get people out just to minister to them. And so I keep encouraging you, pray for the gifts and signs. They are the thing that will draw the attention of people. That's why God sent them in the church. They've been absent. That's why you can't get people to come out. You just get a little word out that that somebody got healed over at Muncie or in Anderson. You watch what happens next to you. I mean, some miracle took place. So I'm all for it. Praise God. The thing is, she was teaching the same thing I'm teaching there. And I don't think there's anything out about the signs or gifts that follow the covenants. Never heard of her, or I just haven't been around.
So there's a name, Catherine Kuhlman, we haven't mentioned so far today, John. But, you know, Catherine Kuhlman was huge in the 1960s. I don't know a lot about her. I think she was born in the Midwest. Only thing I can remember, I remember several things about Catherine Kuhlman. I never saw her in person. I have heard her on and seen her on YouTube videos. And let me just say, that's not to my liking. It is just so theatrical and so, to me, weird and odd and mystical, flowing around in this gown. It's just weird. But anyway, she ended up with a meeting in Pittsburgh and at, I don't know, one of the halls, one of the main auditoriums there, and held meetings in Pittsburgh in that place for years. So in that clip we just heard, Hobart also had just had his own little meeting in Pittsburgh. Of course, he couldn't hold a lamp to Catherine Kuhlman and who she could draw. And he said that in that little clip we just heard, that after he got through with his meeting, before he drove back to Indiana, he knew Catherine Kuhlman was speaking there at her normal venue, and he dropped in to listen to her. And it was totally with approval. And how he approves of her, he said, well, the way you know that God is with this person is we all have the same end time message. That's how you know. Well, of course, because they all borrowed it from one another. It's not because they all got it from God. They all borrowed it from one another. But he said that he dropped in and Catherine Kuhlman was talking about the revelation of the Antichrist, that she thinks the Antichrist is going to be revealed, you know, very shortly. That is precisely what Hobart taught repeatedly in the early 70s. By the early 80s, he isn't talking about it as much because so far Antichrist hasn't been revealed. But he talked about it repeatedly based on his love that he had for the woman Jean Dixon, the psychic. He read her book. She wrote a book called The Gift of Prophecy. He did not believe in Jean Dixon. Let me see, how can I say this? He rejected her as a psychic and as a medium and as a spiritualist, but yet he believed all the revelations that she gave. And one of them was she had seen Antichrist. He had been born, and Hobart believed that Antichrist was alive in the early 70s, only to grow up and soon take over the world.
I mentioned earlier the unusual favoritism that was shown towards Gnosticism. And Gnosticism is the idea that you have the gnosis or the secret knowledge. One of the things that this movement taught, which Hobart Freeman apparently seems to have come into, is that mystics have some truth, and we can believe that some truth, but we can take it a step further because we have the gnosis, only they didn't use the word gnosis. They used something different. But that flowed all through the movement. Branham would talk about how the spiritualists would always pick him out of a crowd because he was, quote unquote, right, born under a sign. He would say that, born under a sign. And they looked so favoratively at spiritualists and mystics because they wanted to create an atmosphere for their own stage personas of mystique. And then you mix that with the theatrics like you're describing. What's interesting, you mentioned Catherine Kuhlman. I have to go back and listen to it again, but I'm almost positive that he was talking about whenever Hall had his, what was it, temple? I can't remember the name of the temple out west, but when he had his temple and he was preaching it anyway, Catherine Kuhlman was apparently one of the people who sat under his teaching. So she was being influenced by it. He mentioned Branham there. Obviously, Branham would have been. But the point is, all of these people were in a cohesive unit as it related to the movement, but were not in cohesion as it related to the theology. And so it didn't matter what theology you had as long as you had the mystique and the stage persona. It was all about that stage persona. So Hobart Freeman apparently decided that he liked that idea and started changing some of his own doctrines, like you mentioned, to match what they had because their ministries were bigger and better and more entertaining, catching more crowds. I don't think that he ever came to their level, but I think he may have been influenced just enough to think, well, if I change this and add this strategy here and tweak this little theology here to match what they're doing, match what the broader charismatic movement is doing, maybe I can have a stronger influence. And whether that was for the good or for the bad, I'm not going to say, but it seems that's what happened.
Well, one thing that we're certain of is that he had to hold on to his belief of some kind of woman in ministry because of Anna Schrader. That was a whole foundation for his ministry. So that happens in 1966, all in the early 70s. He is favorably referencing women missionaries, women in ministry, women just in all kinds of leadership positions. But by the early 1980s, remember he dies in December of 84, he is singing a different tune. By the early 80s, he has shifted away from this blanket approval of women and women in ministry, and he has very obviously changed his mind. And let me just say, that's okay. You know, when people hear me make a critical statement against Hobart and I say he changed his mind and they say, well, isn't that okay? 100%. It's okay to change your mind. We all have that right, and we all need to exercise that right, because if we don't, then we're saying that we've never been wrong about anything. But what Hobart did not have the right to do, yes, he had the right to change his mind. We all have that right. So he agreed with women in ministry. So now by the early 80s, he's against women in ministry, and he's back to his Baptist Grace Brethren view. That's okay. You can flip, flop, and then flip again and flop again if you want to. There's no law saying you can't have position A, then you adopt position B, but then on further study, you go back to position A. We've all worked through various doctrines or theological issues or biblical passages that way. You know, it just depends on not what mood we're in that day, but what is the most convincing evidence in our mind? And, you know, we generally go with whatever the most convincing evidence is. So I'm okay. Let me say it for the umpteenth time with Hobart changing his opinion on women in ministry. I'm okay. He changed from no women in ministry to yes women in ministry back to no women in ministry with one exception. We'll talk about that. And that's the problem to me. Yes, you have the right to change your opinion, but what he did not have the right to do was to be so rough on his congregation with this new position that they didn't know that he had, that all of a sudden he has come into, and he doesn't give them the same leeway, the same amount of time that he had in arriving at this position. The same's true, John, with all of his teaching on doctors and medicine. And, you know, at one time, Hobart wasn't opposed to doctors and medicine. He wasn't going to take them medicine himself, but he wasn't opposed if someone else wanted to. He eventually got to a very strict position of no medicine, no medical science, no working in the medical field, and expected everyone else, just because he had arrived now at that position, expected everyone else to agree with him wholeheartedly and not give them a couple of years to think about it like he had spent a couple of years thinking about it. So I said doesn't have the right to be rough on the people. What am I talking about? Well, he did change his position. He changed his position by the early 1980s, and where it comes out most forcefully is in his studies in 1st and 2nd Corinthians. He decided to teach these two books, the two epistles of Paul to the saints at Corinth. He did it from 1981 to 1983 in a series of 59 messages. Here is my own handbook typed up. You know, I would study Dr. Freeman's notes, you know, or study his messages. I'd write it out. So here's all my typed out notes from these 59 messages on 1st and 2nd Corinthians. I know he did it from 81 to 83. It was probably a couple of years after that I actually was able to obtain them and listen to them myself. And you know, John, if you're going to do a study on 1 Corinthians, eventually you're going to get to chapter 14. And eventually you're going to get to the end of chapter 14. And eventually you're going to come across this passage that says women are not allowed to speak in church. And if they will learn anything, they must ask their husbands at home. Oh, no. Now I've got to teach on this and talk about this. And so he does. But his position is not what it had been back in the Glory Barn days. So he has two tapes, John, parts one and parts two, entitled, Should Women Speak in Church? And, you know, that's just a bombshell of a topic. It's a divisive topic for sure. It is talked about in the Bible, so by all means, teach on it if you are a pastor of a church. But you're going to take your life in your own hands when you do. But Hobart is the master of this congregation. And so on the first tape, part one, Should Women Speak in Church, he gives the different views of what does Paul mean when he says women are not allowed to speak in church. He just goes through what he thinks are the wrong, incorrect views, but different views on how to interpret that passage. He gets toward the very end of this message, and we are going to play this clip. And he ends up by going down the line of the fivefold ministry offices of Ephesians 4:11. He talks about the teacher, the apostle, the pastor, the evangelist. Notice he's left out the prophet. He goes down the list. He talks about those four. And he says that none of these can be found filled by a woman in the New Testament. But then he doesn't rule out the prophetess. He rules out the other four and goes down the line and said, none of these can be found in the New Testament, but he doesn't rule out the prophetess. And he says, oh, I'm going to teach on that later, but they can exist. And he is going to teach on it the next week and in the next message. But what happens, John, at the 43-minute and 9-second mark is a woman interrupts him. He is actually asking, you can barely hear it on the message, but you can tell from his response, you can tell automatically exactly what's happened. He's asking for, does anyone know, maybe I have not thought of it, can anyone think of a prophetess being in the New Testament? Well, you can tell from the comment that a woman makes it, and she's referring to the passage in Acts 21 or 22, I can't remember which chapter, where it mentions that Philip, the evangelist, had four daughters, all of whom were virgins and all of whom prophesied. Doesn't say they're prophetesses, but said they prophesied. So this woman brings that up as, an alleged place in the New Testament where there was a woman prophetess. So if we could hear, and this is going to be hard on your soul and your ears, because he takes this woman to task. From the 43-minute and 9-second mark to the 45-minute and 21-second mark.
That's Old Testament. Well, they prophesied. Now, see, you need to hear our tapes on the gifts. That's the simple gift of prophecy. You can prophesy and not necessarily be a prophet or a prophetess. See, all that's dealt with on the gifts of the Spirit. And I wouldn't put you down for the world, sister, but does that come under verses 34 and 35? I mean, we have to face this, friends. She just asked a question in public. Paul says, don't do that, ladies. I wasn't throwing that out to ladies and gentlemen and children. I thought a man would answer if he knew about it. This is the way we learn. Now, some of you may stare at the floor and roll your eyes and clear your throat because I come right to the point. But that's how we've got to learn to obey this word. This is an end time work, and God is trying to bring you into shape and condition to conform to Jesus and His word. Women should not question in the public service. I just read it. And if they learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home. It's a shame for a woman to ask a question in the church. And that's no put down to her, but how else are you going to learn if we've been studying this for an hour and we get a question? Hey, friends, you got to get serious. There's still some empty seats out there that where they wouldn't take us seriously. Just like the clothing thing, that may be just enough to push some of you over the brink. You could handle everything but the culottes. I don't know. We may be down to 300 Gideons with dresses and men's clothing on. We just may be. Maybe that's what will do it. I told you, I've told you for years, it's the word that'll separate. And those who won't obey it will accuse us of legalism and blah, 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 but that's too bad for them. So the only scriptural office in the Bible, I'm just going to say Bible, not Old or New Testament, is prophetess for the woman of the fivefold.
I mean, there is a way in which he is, I don't know, maybe gentle to start with when he said, I wouldn't hurt your feelings for the world, sister. However, haven't I just given a teaching that women have to shut up in church? And here you are talking in church. And as it goes on, as we just heard, he's hard on this poor lady. I wonder who that lady was. Surely someone out there in our audience was there listening to the 1 Corinthians 14 teaching and heard that. And, you know, Hobart talks about, I mean, Hobart just, he runs over her and he said, you can clear your throat, look at the ceiling, look down at the floor, but, you know, I'm going to tell it like it is. You know, this is an end time work. This is an end time message, blah, blah, blah. Instead of John saying, look, I need to explain that I used to agree with women in ministry, and I no longer do. And here are the reasons why. And I'm going to try to share my understanding of Scripture with all of you folks, including all of you dear women out there. And from this point forward, you know, we're not going to be able to have that belief anymore. But since I obviously, it took me 10 years to go away from women in ministry to now a woman can't even speak in the church. Since it took me 10 years, I'm going to give all of you ladies some time to digest this and think about it. And, you know, and we'll reach this position here together at some point in the future. Instead of doing that, it's just, I believe this now and you have to believe it as well.
It reminds me of the masks in theater. You put on a different mask and it's a different person. That's the same thing Branham would do when he would go from church to church of different doctrine. You put on a mask and it doesn't matter what you've taught to all of the people before that you believed. And no explanation, like you said, no explanation at all for the change. It just happens.
And then, John, we're not going to play any clips, but I would encourage people, if they want to hear all of this and hear it in context, to look up these two messages on YouTube, Should a Woman Speak in Church, Part 1 and Part 2. The end of Part 1 is where he takes this woman to task. And I'll never forget, you know, I'm sitting there listening to my old cassette tape player, wherever I was, and I hear this woman, and I go, oh, no. The boom is getting ready to fall on this poor lady. And sure enough, it does. And it should not have been that way. The second thing, and this is probably the most important point I want to make, is that on the next tape, the next one, Should Women Speak in Church Part 2, he pretends that he didn't earlier hold to a different view. And you know how he does it? And I was shocked and I was angered, to be honest with you. I was shocked and I was angered. He takes a verse from the upper room discourse in John's gospel, completely out of context, where Jesus told the disciples, I'm going to depart, but I'm going to send the Holy Spirit to you, and things that you can't receive right now, the Holy Spirit will teach you those things. Hobart takes that verse. He's used it like this in several regards. And he uses it like this, John. He uses it to pretend like I had the truth the whole time, but you weren't ready to receive it yet. You weren't to the spiritual place you could receive it. I had it all the time. But God has a time to bring forth every truth. This is what you'll hear on the first of those two messages. God has a time. And that time was not earlier, that time is now. And that is just a blatant lie. That's a person knowingly, I mean, right in public, being dishonest. Hobart didn't hold that view earlier. And you can tell that from all of his early tapes. What he has done is he has shifted his opinion, but he doesn't have the Christian maturity or integrity to be able to say, I've got a whole different belief on this now. And we know, John, the reason people don't acknowledge that they changed their view is they're afraid that people won't follow them in the future. You know, hey, if you didn't believe this in the past and now you do, well, who's to say you're right now? I have a lot of respect, a tremendous amount of respect for someone who would come up front behind the pulpit and say, I formerly held to women in ministry offices, but I no longer do, and here are the reasons why. I have a lot of respect for that. Why wouldn't you respect that? Whether I agree with his current position or his former one is beside the point. It's just the fact that he has the maturity of an adult to say, I didn't have it right, and I do think I have it right now. The problem, however, with Dr. Freeman was he kept holding on to this prophetess. He changed his whole view about women in ministry, but he never did change his view about a female prophetess. Here in my own notes, at the very end of that message, here's what I typed out. I write, Freeman says that he does not have a proof text for a prophetess today, but he believes they can and do exist. So he has to admit there are no prophetesses. Now, there's Anna, the prophetess, in the early chapters of Luke's gospel, but we're talking, that's in the Old Testament economy. We're talking about in the church, after the church is founded. He had to admit there's no true prophetess. There's no woman in any kind of ministry office in the church. He has to admit that. But he won't give up the fact that there can be and are female prophetesses. And why won't he give that up? One reason, and one reason only. And that's because his whole ministry was founded from a prophecy given by the prophetess Anna Schrader.
And I can't wait to get into Anna Schrader more and her connection to all of this and Branham's connection to helping create this mess. There's so many aspects of this that go so far beyond Hobart Freeman. It's quite interesting. Thank you so much for doing this.
You bet. Thanks, Sean.
If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.